world. Her interests are on every street. Her name is on every tongue. Those interests, so sacred and stupendous, should be trusted only to the care of those whose power, skill, and courage have been tested and approved. Applause. And in the man whom you will choose, the highest sense of every nation in the world beholds a man who typifies, as no other living American does, the spirit and purposes of the 20th century. It was just 11 o'clock. "Gentlemen," Black roared, "I nominate for President of the United States Theodore Roosevelt of New York." An elemental din built and built, and for 21 minutes the convention rocked in pandemonium. 3 sergeants-at-arms carried in Roosevelt's portrait, crudely rendered in crayon, yet big enough to blot out most of Mark Hanna's. They swung the president from side to side while he gazed with waxy eyes at the party he could at last call his own. The real Roosevelt received the news of his nomination, along with that of Fairbanks for vice president, and confirmation of Cortelyou as chairman, just after lunch, as he sat with Edith and Alice on the White House portico. His secretary, Loeb, brought the telegram. The vote had been unanimous, but every state from Alabama to Wyoming had insisted on recording its tally separately, making 994 votes out of 994. With kisses on his cheeks, he walked happily to his office and met a congratulatory crowd of newsmen. He invited them in for an executive session and tilted back laughing in his big chair as they fired questions at him. Prophecies, jokes, reminiscences, and indiscretions poured out freely, enchantingly. Roosevelt asked that nothing he said be printed, and nothing ever was. That evening, Mr. Perdicaris strolled for the last time on the village green at Saradon. His hurt leg had long since healed. Yesterday's messages to the effect that His Cherifian Majesty was most graciously pleased to accede to the demands of Rasuli had come too late for quick departure, but the ransom caravan was definitely on its way, and a descent from the mountains was planned for the morning. Mr. Perdicaris slept no better than he had on his first night, 5 weeks before. At 4 a.m. on 24 June, horses and pack mules were made ready, and soon a long cortege was snaking north to Mount Nazul. Rasuli rode behind the hostages on a gray charger, dark cords of camel hair twisted about his turban, and a cartridge belt slapped his broad chest. "Every inch," Mr. Perdicaris thought enviously, "a man of daring deeds." They crested Nazul just as the sun did, and in the bursting light all the peaks and ridges around them, wreathed in lower mists, turned amethyst and rose, crimson and lilac. The old man reined to a halt, enraptured by one of the most gorgeous displays of color he had ever seen. Rasuli, grinning, asked if he regretted his involuntary mountain vacation. Keeping to the ridge, they continued north and eventually sighted a white fleck in the blue distance, which Rasuli said was Tangier. Around noon, they found themselves looking down on the town of El Zalal, where the meeting with the Sultan's emissaries was to take place. Many hours later, when the last stacks of silver coin had been counted and the political prisoners handed over and 2 ceremonial luncheons eaten, Rasuli took Mr. Perdicaris aside and said goodbye. He promised that if anyone tried to harm him, "I will come with all my men to your rescue." Mr. Perdicaris was more inclined to cry than laugh. Affectionately drawn to Rasuli, even as he rejoiced for himself, he mounted his black horse and rode off with the Sultan's party. Other emotions struggled in his breast toward midnight, when Tangier came into view, and he saw in the harbor the mastheads of Admiral Chadwick's ships, twinkling the news of his return. As a youth, Mr. Perdicaris had thought little of his American citizenship and bartered it away to avoid taxation during the Civil War. Too much money and travel had made him complacent and careless of formalities. There would be many awkward questions asked soon enough before the State Department decided to forgive him, but he had no doubt now where and to whom his allegiance belonged. "Thank heaven," he said to himself, It is that flag and that people, I and that president, behind those frigates, thousands of miles away, who have had me dug out from amongst these cabals. That flag and no other. Chapter 22. The Most Absurd Political Campaign of Our Time. I think a lot of us likes Teddy Roosevelt, that wouldn't ever be suspected of voting for him. The difficulty of mounting a serious challenge to Theodore Roosevelt's candidacy in 1904 became apparent when the Prohibition Party gave its backing to a man named Silas Swallow. To the regret of satirists and cartoonists, Mr. Swallow was unable to choose the General Secretary of the Methodist Conference, Ezra Tipple, as his running mate. Tipple was a Roosevelt supporter. So, by late June, were such reluctant converts as J.P. Morgan and E.H. Harriman. James J. Hill remained adamantly opposed, as did George F. Baer of coal strike infamy. But many conservative Democrats, including George J. Gould, James Speyer, and Jacob H. Schiff, let Cornelius Bliss, who had agreed to serve as Republican campaign treasurer, know that he could rely on them for money. For such men, memories of William Jennings Bryan's two disastrous free silver campaigns were worse than their apprehensions of Roosevelt's square deal. There was no chance that the Democratic National Convention, assembling in St. Louis as Roosevelt headed home from Washington in early July, would nominate Bryan again. When Bryan himself arrived at the local Coliseum, he found himself seated about two-thirds of the way down the aisle, about where he had sunk in party esteem. Yet faded as the commoner now seemed, with his balding head and resonant, empty voice, he was more vivid a personality than the likely nominee. Alton Brooks Parker, Chief Justice of the New York Court of Appeals, was gray enough to defeat the new science of autochrome photography. Drably decent, colorlessly correct at 52, Parker dressed, by habit, in a gray cutaway coat and gray cutaway trousers. He lived in a gray house overlooking the gray waters of the Hudson, and was the author of many gray legal opinions, so carefully worded that neither plaintiffs nor defendants knew what he really felt on any given issue. Even the heart of Alton B. Parker was a gray area. Roosevelt had foreseen the judge's candidacy for years. He knew Parker from gubernatorial days, and feared him precisely because he was colorless. "The neutral-tinted individual," he wrote George Otto Trevelyan, "is very apt to win against the man of pronounced views and active life." Personally, he liked Parker very much. The judge was attractive on close acquaintance. Big and solid as an upstate lumberman, he exuded healthy, untroubled self-confidence. No furrow of doubt marred the smooth brow. His jaw was forceful, and his mustache, graying but still tinged with auburn, curved easily and often into a thick-lipped grin. If his conversation was bland, tending toward boring, that was no novelty in a politician, and Parker was a politician for all his judicial demeanor. 18 years of public nonpartisanship had not erased Republican memories of Parker managing David B. Hill's landslide campaign for governor in 1884. Even Hill, the arch-Democrat, had jibbed against supporting Bryan in 1896, yet Parker had tranquilly voted for free silver and toilers everywhere before accepting the most privileged seat on the New York bench. As a result, he could look Western miners in the eye and say that he had never deserted them, and behave with equal complacency at gold-dollar banquets hosted by August P. Belmont. No wonder Hill, still state boss and anxious to return old favors, saw him as the potential unifier of the Democratic Party. And so did most of the 962 other delegates who took their seats in St. Louis on Wednesday, 6 July. About 100 conservatives would have supported Grover Cleveland, had the former president agreed to run, and about 200 radicals were pledged or beholden to William Randolph Hearst. All Hill had to do was marshal a majority that was two-thirds greater than these minorities to nominate Parker. But first, all factions had to agree on a platform. On Friday, a little knot of newsmen gathered outside Parker's house in Esopus, New York, waiting for the hall telephone to ring with good news for him. It remained silent all day. Around sunset, a press dispatch arrived, saying that ideological squabbling in St. Louis was preventing any progress toward the judge's nomination. William Jennings Bryan had waged such a fanatic battle against any mention of gold in the platform that the Committee on Resolutions might recommend no currency plank at all. There was an instant clamor for Parker. He came onto the porch, genial and impassive, and listened to the dispatch. "I thank you, gentlemen, for the opportunity to comment." Pencils bristled eagerly, and he pointed at a sailboat on the Hudson. "It's a pretty sight, isn't it?" With this witticism, he retired for the evening. A reporter called after him, asking sarcastically when he would be available if more news came. "The usual hour," said Parker, and waved good night. That meant early the next morning, when he took his regular swim. Fog rolled up from the river and blanketed the moon. The newsmen smoked and dozed in rocking chairs. Eventually the fog began to whiten, but it did not burn away with dawn. Dew dripped from 3,000 apple trees. At 6:35 a.m., the New York Times man saw Parker slip out of the back of the house, bare-legged, in an old rubber raincoat. He was tempted to follow him downhill, but decided to stick near the telephone. It shrilled just 13 minutes later. Parker's secretary came out to announce that the judge had been nominated unanimously on the first ballot. Only one reporter knew where Parker was. He ran down the slope and encountered a big wet man at the water's edge. "Judge, you've got it." "Oh, is that so?" A foghorn bleated on the river. Parker pulled on his raincoat and walked up the hill, shivering slightly. The other reporters saw him coming and took off their hats. He shook hands with them all. Somebody handed him the telephone message, and he read it with drops of water trickling down his face. Even at this moment, Parker could not express his emotions. "No," he said, "I will reserve anything I have to say until I am officially notified." He stepped onto the porch, tall, cold, glowing with health, clutching the achievement of his life in his hand. Inside, breakfast awaited him, and the Democratic newspapers. They were full of disapproving accounts of Bryan's currency plank abandonment. One especially angry editorial caught his eye. "At this hour of writing, before the taking of the ballot, we are assuming the nomination of Judge Parker. He must at once declare, sound money Democrats will demand that he declare, that the gold monetary standard, as now established by law, is permanent. Judge Parker must understand that, making his canvass on this platform without a public profession of his personal belief, he cannot expect to receive the support and votes of the sound money Democrats of the East. They will desert him by the tens of thousands. Better another term of Roosevelt. Better Roosevelt indefinitely than one term of a president incapable of yielding in the slightest degree to the dangerous demands of a party which confesses itself to be still insane and unsafe." Parker ate and drank and thought, then changed into riding clothes and went out alone on horseback. Shortly before noon he returned, summoned his secretary, and dictated a telegram to William F. Sheehan, leader of the New York delegation at St. Louis. The telegram was so blunt that Western Union called for verification. It reached the convention hall just as delegates were assembling to nominate a vice presidential candidate. Sheehan instantly suppressed it, but he and Hill could not hide their panic, and a wave of rumor swept the Coliseum. Had Judge Parker refused to run? "The Democratic Party," Senator Tillman shouted, "can always be relied on to make a damn fool of itself at the critical time." After 4 hours, the telegram was finally read aloud from the rostrum. "I regard the gold standard as firmly and irrevocably established, and shall act accordingly if the action of the convention shall be ratified by the people. As the platform is silent on the subject, my view should be made known to the convention, and if it is proved to be unsatisfactory to the majority, I request you to decline the nomination before adjournment. Alton Parker." Parker's words were rather less surprising than his tone, which came as a cold slap in the convention's hot, weary face. She and other leaders worked desperately to assure delegates that the judge meant no dictation. He was just merely behaving like a man of rectitude and honor. There was no move to withdraw the nomination, but the rest of the proceedings were anticlimactic. An 80-year-old multimillionaire, Henry G. Davis of West Virginia, was endorsed for vice president in hopes that he might contribute to the campaign. Then 1,000 uninspired Democrats headed for their hotel rooms. Roosevelt was full of admiration for Parker's telegram. "It was a bold and skillful move," he wrote Henry Cabot Lodge. He doubted that the judge had any personal principles on the subject of gold. In waiting until the last minute to instruct the convention, Parker had become a very formidable candidate and opponent. Professionals in both parties were similarly impressed. As Roosevelt predicted, the New York Evening Post endorsed Parker in near adulatory terms. Other New York newspapers to support him were the Times, Herald, World, and Stadtzeitung. The Brooklyn Eagle, Boston Herald, Detroit Free Press, Milwaukee Journal, and, worryingly, the Springfield Republican followed suit. Every one had supported McKinley in 1900. Time would tell if the Parker wave represented a temporary swell or some real shifting of the political current. Many warm, placid weeks lay ahead before political activity picked up again in September. Almost all of the official campaigning would be done by the two national committees and their treasurers and copywriters and speakers. Roosevelt and Parker were required to do nothing except make one acceptance speech and write one acceptance letter apiece. Both candidates were expected to sit out the planning phase of the campaign in their respective retreats, although Roosevelt had scheduled a midsummer visit to Washington to confer with party tacticians. In the meantime, clams were spouting in Cold Spring Harbor, and the corn was green on Sagamore Hill. Distant picnic spots beckoned, and the waters of the bay cried out for the splash of oars. Even from the austere heights of Esopus, New York, the Hudson showed more than a hint of blue. On 27 July, 54 solemn Republicans creaked up Sagamore Hill in a dusty procession of buggies. Despite the heat, they all wore neckties and stiff collars, and their trousers were ironed to knife edges, even, incredibly, those of Speaker Cannon. One and all were solemn, for they were enacting the party's most hallowed ritual, a formal notification of nomination to its presidential candidate. Roosevelt awaited them on the broad porch, surrounded by his wife and a clutch of children. He wore a frock coat and white waistcoat. The visitors respectfully banged the dust from their hats before mounting the steps to shake his hand. William Loeb brought out a low stool for Cannon to stand on. The speaker teetered awkwardly and drew a typed speech from his pocket. "It's 7 minutes long," he apologized. As he read a condensed version of the Chicago platform, the sea breeze brought up scents of hay. Flags snapped on the house's high roof. Roosevelt swayed with pleasure, patting one of his nephews on the head. He kept glancing toward Edith, aloof in filmy white lace. "That's perfectly true," he interrupted at one point. "Perfectly true." When the president's turn came, Alice Roosevelt, unnoticed till now, eased through the crowd and stood slightly behind him, where he could not see her. Her eyes never left his face. He spoke for 12 minutes and used the word power a lot. She laughed with delight at every burst of applause. Later, as the younger Roosevelt served croquettes, ice cream, and lemonade on the lawn, she moved gracefully about, beguiling man after man with her 20-year-old body and gray-blue, almost phosphorescent eyes. Something flickered at her wrist. A bright green snake twined round her fingers and wriggled up the front of her dress. Roosevelt paid no attention. He was more interested in checking whom Governor Odell was talking to on a secluded bench in the garden. Alice was not the only one of his children to wear reptiles next to the skin. She was, however, the only one who resented him, though loving him with equal violence. Her attitude toward herself was equally confused. "I feel that I want something, I don't know what." At times, in her padlocked diary, she fantasized symbols of escape, a roadster, a rich husband, a world tour, a London season. Roosevelt's political reasons for refusing to indulge her drove her to such paroxysms of rage that her handwriting degenerated into a near maniacal scribble. At other times, like this, she luxuriated in his aura of power, much as the snake enjoyed the warmth of her own bodice. "When I come down to bedrock facts," Alice told herself, "I am more interested in my father's political career than anything in the world. Of course I want him reelected, but there again, I am afraid it is because it would keep me in my present position." Roosevelt's thoughtful observance of Governor Odell, parchment-pale, rumpled and glowering, in the garden, betrayed his worry that the dour politico might prove a liability in the election. Since both presidential candidates happened to be New Yorkers, the Empire State's vote was bound to be unusually partisan. Odell had proved to be a gifted administrator, pushing through wider reforms than Roosevelt himself had done, saving more money and overhauling the party machinery. Politically, however, the governor was being overtaken by accelerating trends that he was powerless to understand, much less control. He still thought that labor should defer to capital, that New York City and New York State had more things in common than not, that party discipline guaranteed straight-ticket voting. These 19th-century notions were challenged by evidence that New York State's independent vote was growing and might well return a Democrat to Albany, if not to Washington, D.C. After two terms, Odell was not popular enough to run again, but having painstakingly made himself party boss, he wanted to remain so. Much to the disgust of Democrats, he had forced the state Republican committee to elect him its chairman. This brazen mixing of executive politics and electioneering was sure to be a campaign issue, particularly if Odell tried to choose his own successor. Roosevelt dreaded the prospect of having to carry a heavy puppet should the presidential race become close. New York State represented the nation's largest block of electoral votes. It was vital, therefore, to find a gubernatorial candidate who would be perceived as a Roosevelt Republican. Odell did not object, as long as he was consulted. He agreed with the president that one New Yorker, above all others, had the integrity and stature to sweep the state. Unfortunately, Elihu Root was adamant about remaining in private life. "I must ask my friends to accept as final the refusal of the nomination." To make things doubly plain, he stayed away from Sagamore Hill. The press noted Root's absence from the notification ceremony, as did other national strategists. At their behest, Roosevelt wrote his old friend and proffered the most glittering of grails. "The Republicans of this country are turning their eyes towards you as being the man who, by present appearances, would, if elected governor of New York, become the foremost Republican in the land and the natural leader of the party. You would become the man likely to be nominated by the Republicans for the presidency in 1908. Root politely declined. He told Henry Cabot Lodge that after serving at the national level, he had developed a perfect loathing and disgust for the sordid details of state politics. He suspected that Governor Odell's inheritance might be corrupt. 5 years of overwork under two presidents had left him drained. He was almost 60. Even if the grail were offered him, he would be 63 before he could hold it. More to the point, he simply did not want it. On the day after the notification ceremony, Roosevelt returned to the Capitol he had so recently quit. With what John Hay described as cheery cruelty, he insisted that his cabinet officers break their vacations and join him. Questions of labor and monetary policy had to be discussed before he could issue his acceptance letter, and another potential Mediterranean crisis, this time in Turkey, required group attention. Mrs. Roosevelt's added presence indicated that he was in no hurry to go home. Washington sweltered and stagnated, dust settled on doorsteps in the northwest sector, etching the panels of barred doors. For block after block, blinds filled every window, giving the city an empty, eyeless look. John Hay took afternoon drives in vain search of breezes. Eastward along Pennsylvania Avenue, the air boiled silently over the sidewalks. Capitol Hill floated like a mirage, about to slide over the horizon. It was too hot for birds to sing. The trees around the White House rang with beetles. Inside, the big stone mansion was cool and fragrant with cut flowers. Roosevelt worked mornings only, debating what to do about a meat workers' strike in Chicago and about a treaty-breaking refusal by Turkey to grant American missionaries the same privileges enjoyed by those from European nations. The first question was easy to answer in an election year. He would do nothing. But the second begged comparisons with Perdicaris's kidnapping, in that it involved a desperate envoy, a languid sultan, and conveniently available units of the United States Navy. Roosevelt decided on 5 August to dispatch Admiral Jewell's 3 fast cruisers to the Levant in a further demonstration of goodwill. Freed for a few weeks from the demands of fatherhood and reveling in the luxury of being alone with his sweetest of all sweet girls, he wrote to his sister, Bammy. "Edith and I are having a really lovely time in Washington. The house is delightful. We breakfast on the portico and then stroll in the garden, and at night we walk through the garden or on the terraces. Tomorrow we intend to cut church and to ride out to Burnt Mills to spend the day walking through the gorge. The next 3 months will be wearing at times. I have no idea what the outcome will be, and I know that, as I shall hear little but what is favorable, it will be impossible for me to tell. However, come what may, I have achieved certain substantial results, have made an honorable name to leave the children, and will have completed by March 4th next pretty nearly 7 years of work, dating from the time I became lieutenant colonel of my regiment, which has been of absorbing interest and of real importance. So, while if defeated I shall feel disappointed, yet I shall also feel that I have had far more happiness and success than fall to any but a very few men. And this aside from the infinitely more important fact that I have had the happiest home life of any man whom I have ever known." In New York, where the summer heat was only a degree or two less intense, George B. Cordelieu moved into a modern suite of offices at 1 Madison Avenue. Old Guard visitors, used to the noisy disorder of earlier campaign headquarters, felt that they had stumbled into the premises of a small, efficient corporation. "The brass band has departed," James Clarkson remarked with a touch of sadness. Polite young men sat at neat desks and spent a great deal of time on the telephone. There was not a spittoon to be seen. The chairman himself occupied a big room on the 4th floor, overlooking Madison Square. Somehow, the sunbeams angling in left him cool. He wore a stiff white vest at all times, and his handshake was dry. He slapped no backs and never went into a huddle, as Hannah used to do. The contrast with his burly, lapel-gripping predecessor was total. Cordelieu diffused a quieter authority, no less potent. Success became him. He had lost the drawn, intense look of his 30s. A female reporter admired his geometric grooming, the tie precisely pinned, the dark, silver-streaked hair brilliantined back. Also unlike Hannah, Cordelieu left the responsibility of soliciting contributions to professional money men. Cornelius Bliss was given responsibility for Eastern fundraising. Charles Dawes collected west of the Mississippi. The chairman made it clear that Roosevelt must be elected upon an absolutely clean and business basis. To that end, he abolished the old bureaus, ethnic, industrial, religious, and social, that used to serve as two-way conduits between the Republican National Committee and special interest groups. The only bureau he kept was that of speakers, awarding it to his enemy, Nathan B. Scott. The senator softened, as did members of the old guard, who realized that they had misjudged Cordelieu. The contacts he had built up in 18 months as Secretary of Commerce and Labor were not inconsiderable. Even the great J.P. Morgan was said to admire him. "Cordelieu is a splendid executive, resourceful and tactful and masterful," Dawes wrote in his diary. "Am delighted with the way he takes hold of things." Roosevelt tried once to issue a set of moral instructions, but when he tried a second time, Cordelieu courteously lost his temper. "If I didn't know you as well as I do, I should resent you sending me such a communication," the chairman wrote. Whatever may be my shortcomings, and there are many, I think I have a fair degree of moral fiber. I am conducting this campaign for your re-election on as high a plane as you have conducted the affairs of your great office." Roosevelt had long wanted to smash the Ottoman Empire as a passé power, opulent and corrupt. While not exactly violating the terms of her Most Favored Nation agreement with the United States, Turkey had, for more than a year, been so discriminatory toward American missionaries and school teachers, and so obstructive in dealing with American diplomats throughout the Ottoman Empire, that the treaty might as well have been written in water. John G. Leishman, the United States minister in Constantinople, reported that the Sublime Porte, as Sultan Abdulhamid's government was called, had closed on him once too often. He demanded a military response. On 8 August, Hay, who was an adroit politician behind his courtly whiskers, suggested to Roosevelt that Leishman should knock on the port just once more, just as Admiral Jewell's squadron arrived at Smyrna. If the Sultan then reacted as obligingly as his Cherifian Majesty had in Tangier, and granted all the minister's claims, Roosevelt would be congratulated on a brilliant diplomatic victory without having landed a single Marine. If, however, the Sultan pleaded one of his usual excuses, fatigue, indisposition, a prior engagement in the harem, Leishman should come away in one of the ships, and the matter be referred to Congress. Roosevelt would then look like a responsible commander-in-chief, while all danger of bloodshed would be postponed until after the election. The President agreed, and Hay sent new instructions to Leishman. As headlines on the Turkish crisis grew larger, and European diplomats hurried back to Washington from vacation, Democratic National Committee officials competed for attention by notifying Alton B. Parker of his nomination for the presidency. Their high hopes were dampened in more ways than one on Wednesday, 10 August, the day set for the ceremony. Once more, fog shrouded Esopus, and rain fell in sheets on Parker's steep lawn, bleeding mud into the river. At midday, a small steamer brought the committeemen north from New York City. They disembarked at the pier and looked askance at the slippery path up to the house. An authoritative escort aligned them two abreast and shouted, "Forward march!" Almost immediately their formation broke up as they floundered and lost traction. One toiler, bent almost double, was heard to say that the hero of San Juan himself couldn't climb this hill. August Belmont's shoes raced on a patch of slime, and he tumbled backward. Fortunately, someone caught him, or the party's richest benefactor would have ended up in the Hudson. Parker waited on the porch until they came up, drenched and puffing, to shake his hand. He led the way to an open dais in the garden. About 2,000 friends and townspeople sat patiently under low umbrellas. Congressman Champ Clark of Missouri made the notification address and handed over a moist copy of the St. Louis platform. Camera bulbs popped in the drizzle. Then the judge, bareheaded, made his first political address in nearly two decades. His declamation came as a surprise to the sodden crowd. He spoke confidently, incisively, like his rival, with little risings of the voice and sideways jabs of the arm. Yet somehow the Rooseveltian air of command was missing. At one point, he broke from his text to urge an exposed group of listeners to take shelter under the trees. "You can hear just as well, and you won't get wet." Nobody moved. The speech itself was uninspiring. Like Roosevelt, Parker summarized his party's campaign philosophy, but apologetically, as if he was embarrassed by the limp envelope in his pocket. He attacked the president's refusal to name a date for Philippine independence, without suggesting a date himself. He seemed unable to utter the words Morocco and Turkey when he harumphed, "I protest against the feeling, now far too prevalent, that by reason of the commanding position we have assumed in the world, we must take part in the disputes and broils of foreign countries." Parker received his longest burst of applause when he announced that if elected, he would serve only one term. Fate conspired to spoil even his final accolade. Just as cold hands began to clap, a photographer yelled for quiet. Down came umbrellas and hats, and everybody posed motionless in the sifting rain. Afterward, loyal commentators hailed Parker's speech as a workmanlike synthesis of all that the Democratic Party stood for. Only the most fervent found anything to admire in his literary style and stage presence. Adjectives such as impersonal, sober, labored, and heavy recurred in editorial columns from Boston to San Francisco. If politics was supposed to be interesting, then Theodore Roosevelt was elected already. An educated electorate would presumably, however, concentrate on the issues that divided the two candidates. Their acceptance speeches, plus the party platforms and convention proceedings, could now be published in campaign textbooks for editors and other speakers to expound on. Cortelyou's textbook presented the Republican Party as the guardian of prosperity, the guarantor of high tariffs, the resolver of labor disputes, and the original upholder of the gold standard. It boasted of the emancipation of Cuba, the Philippines Armistice, the Panama Canal Act, and the Hay-Bonavarria Treaty. It reminded Northeasterners that the president had settled the coal strike, and Southwesterners that he was making the desert blossom. Without actually using the word Negro, it said that any states guilty of special discrimination in suffrage should be penalized by reduced representation in Congress. The Democratic textbook, much thinner, noted that Republican prosperity benefited Wall Street more than Main Street, while protectionism made American goods cheaper abroad than at home. It accused Roosevelt of disrespect for the Constitution, and promised that President Parker would set his face sternly against executive usurpation of legislative and judicial functions. His administration would not be spasmodic, erratic, sensational, spectacular, and arbitrary. Abroad, Democrats were for Philippine independence and against jingoism, imperialism, and the display of great military armaments. At home, they deplored what they saw as Roosevelt's attempts to kindle anew the embers of racial and sectional strife. Neither party had anything specific to say about trust control, labor policy, or tariff reform. Both candidates agreed that the Panama Canal would be of vast benefit to mankind. Parker said nothing about lynchings, still occurring at a rate of 1 every 4 days, and Roosevelt, having courageously raised the subject in 1903, was content to let it rest. Major press endorsements were not expected until the fall, yet the most eagerly awaited came with devastating suddenness on 11 August, fewer than 24 hours after Parker's speech. For as long as anyone could remember, the New York Sun had visited its wrath on any politician, Republican or Democrat, who presumed to interfere with the free workings of capital, as Roosevelt had done during the coal strike. But the paper's editors compared his record with Parker's rhetoric and announced their decision in 5 weary words. Theodore, with all thy faults. Within days of the arrival of Admiral Jewell's squadron at Smyrna, Minister Leishman advised that Abdulhamid had promised, in an informal memorandum, that there was to be no discrimination between American schools and those of other nationalities anywhere in his sultanate. Clearly, Turkey's willingness to negotiate was related to the weight of armor on her doorstep. Leishman would have preferred something more binding than a note scribbled by a secretary, but Roosevelt hastened to proclaim victory without violence. He ordered Leishman to accept the Sultan's word without question, adding, "Inform Admiral that fleet can now leave." Thanks to Hayes' restraint, Roosevelt the candidate was able to bask in praise of his statesmanship. He wished that the election could be held next Tuesday. Even critical commentators were reduced to grudging admiration. The Brooklyn Eagle suggested that he had aimed his naval guns at the Democratic enemy, not the Sultan, pointing out that Jewell could have been sent east immediately after the Perticaris affair. But Roosevelt had obviously delayed his grand gesture to coincide with Judge Parker's notification ceremony. The power to seize the psychological moment is the essence of genius in politics, and if anybody doubts that Theodore Roosevelt is a genius, he should reverse himself on this further evidence. The president was now free to resume his summer vacation, but he did so aware that a much more serious crisis was burgeoning in the Far East. For almost a month now, Japanese naval and ground forces had been consolidating themselves around Port Arthur, redoubt of the Liaodong Peninsula and strategic key to both Korea and Manchuria. The Russian-held fortress still stood, but without naval protection, leaving Japan in complete command of the sea approaches. On 20 August, General Morisuke Nogi began a final assault on Port Arthur. Wave after wave of seemingly berserk little infantrymen broke bloodily on the fortress walls for 2 nights and days. But the walls held, and the waves receded, carrying a flotsam of 15,000 dead and wounded. Nogi's army settled down to what looked like a long winter of siege. Farther inland, 3 other Japanese columns converged on Liaoyang, where Russia's main army lay entrenched. On 23 August, there began 9 days of what Review of Reviews called perhaps the most desperate fighting of modern times. 300,000 soldiers tried to kill one another on roads and fields and hills. The Russians, who fought bravely but unimaginatively, fell back mile by mile, battered by Japanese frontal pressure and harassed by surprise attacks on their rear communications. They summoned 10,000 reserves to stay their retreat, in vain. Even behind breastworks, they lost more men than the enemy did. For 48 hours the air was so loud with artillery blasts, at 60 shots a minute, that men wondered if they would ever hear again. "The Russians think only with half a mind," Roosevelt wrote Hay, as birds sang in the quiet woods of Sagamore Hill. "I think the Japanese will whip them handsomely." Senator Beveridge took a similar view of the president's own political battle. "Unless I am in a chloroformed state and merely dreaming, you are going to have the greatest victory since the Civil War." The speaking phase of the campaign got underway as August turned to September. Orators from all parties spread out across the land with prepared texts and throat lozenges. The loudest voice, at first, was that of the socialist presidential candidate, Eugene Debs. "The capitalists made no mistake in nominating Mr. Roosevelt. They know him well. He has nothing in common with the working class." A quieter voice eventually proved to have more effect than any other. From the moment of his selection as Roosevelt's running mate, the 52-year-old Charles W. Fairbanks had been caricatured as a stuffed club and Wall Street puppet. He was mocked for his spindly height, his triple-strand baldness, his prim manners and paper-dry personality. The New York Sun compared him unfavorably to a table of logarithms, while the Evening Post opined that he had been nominated for national security reasons. The maddest anarchist would never think of killing Roosevelt to make Fairbanks president. The puppet comparison worked best. At 6'4", Fairbanks moved and spoke as if he had no life of his own. His voice seemed to emanate from some inner Edison cylinder, and his gestures were correct, but mechanical, as if jerked by hidden wires. At exhortatory moments, his fist would clench, always in the same upheld position. Whenever he delivered a warning, a lank forefinger would shoot up, and he would rock back on his heels. From time to time, both hands would snap open like fans, and remain open until he shook them shut. This awkwardness was oddly compelling on the hustings, but what made Fairbanks so effective was what had made him a millionaire at 40, a quiet power in the Senate, and a presidential possibility for 1908. He simply could not be stopped. The voice droned on relentlessly, the arms kept pumping, and the long legs kept striding, wherever Nathan B. Scott sent him, from White River Junction, Vermont, to Spokane, Washington. Hundreds were amused, thousands bored, hundreds of thousands convinced. If Roosevelt demonstrated the power of personality in American politics, Charles Fairbanks showed the benefit of persistence. The first tests of their combined appeal came on 6 and 13 September, when voters in Vermont and Maine went to the polls to elect governors. August Belmont, who seemed to be managing Parker's campaign over the head of the Democratic National Committee, did not conceal his anxiety. Both states were Republican strongholds, but if the GOP margin was significantly reduced in either, Democrats could take heart for November. In Vermont, however, the Democratic candidate was defeated by a margin greater than even Cordeliu hoped for, and another Republican surge was registered in Maine. "Unless we throw it away, we have the victory," a satisfied president declared. Nothing was heard from the gray house at Esopus, but Parker's usual booming silence. The judge, now retired from the Court of Appeals, remained as inscrutable as if he were still wearing silk. Joseph Pulitzer, the strident owner of the New York World, began to have second thoughts about him. "The people need a judicial chief magistrate, but not too judicial a candidate." The president chose this moment to issue his long-awaited acceptance letter, a 12,000-word enlargement upon his acceptance speech, covering every aspect of Republican policy. At least 12 close advisers, including Root, Cordeliu, Spooner, and a cross-section of lawyers and journalists, had added their own contributions, but the letter's clarity and comprehensiveness were pure Roosevelt, as were its ideological blows at Parker. Coinciding as it did with the GOP triumph in Maine, it had the dizzying effect of a follow-up punch. Its basic theme was the self-contradiction of the St. Louis platform, which failed to reconcile Cleveland's urban conservatism with Bryan's agrarian radicalism. "Our opponents," Roosevelt wrote, "seem at a loss both as to what it is that they really believe and as to how firmly they shall assert their belief in anything." After 8 years of screaming for free silver, they now called for gold, but only because Judge Parker told them to. They solemnly endorsed the civil service law, the repeal of which they demanded in 1900 and 1896. As for the issue of Philippine independence, they have occupied three entirely different positions within 50 days. He proclaimed his own consistency, emphasizing that if elected, he would proceed on exactly the same lines in national defense, insular administration, tariff policy, and management-labor relations. Without even a pass at modesty, he listed his 18 proudest executive achievements, including the coal strike settlement, arbitration of the Venezuela crisis, establishment of the Department of Commerce and Labor, dispatch of the Kishinev petition, and decisive actions in Panama, Tangier, and Smyrna. "There is not a policy, foreign or domestic, which we are now carrying out, which it would not be disastrous to reverse or abandon." Sonorously, he concluded, "We have striven both for civic righteousness and for national greatness, and we have faith to believe that our hands will be upheld by all who feel love of country and trust in the uplifting of mankind." The president's letter was greeted rapturously by Republicans and ruefully by Democrats. Even Harper's Weekly, usually his bitter critic, praised it as a masterful and extraordinarily able document. John Hay wrote to say that Judge Parker must regret ever quitting the state bench. "Well, my part is pretty nearly ended," Roosevelt had to acknowledge as the Republican National Committee took full charge of his campaign in mid-September. After 3 years of bossing George Cordeliu, he faced 8 weeks of being bossed in return, a novel sensation for any president. Cordeliu's first priority was fundraising, now that Wall Streeters were returning to New York from their country places. So for a while, the chairman ceded initiatives to the treasurer. Silver-whiskered, avuncular, discreet Cornelius Bliss went calling on old friends downtown. In office after paneled office, he was welcomed as a money man among money men, someone who knew the dollar's political worth as well as its purchasing power. Speaking the language of money, he had little difficulty in getting financiers to admit that Roosevelt had not harmed the workings of laissez-faire. The Northern Securities suit looked, in retrospect, like a necessary check on illegal combination. "Salutary from every point of view," as the Wall Street Journal conceded. Most of Bliss's visits ended with the scratch of a pen writing many zeros on a slip of paper, or with the even more satisfying sound of banknotes being counted out. Few donors demanded favors in return. When one did, asking to be appointed ambassador to Belgium, Cordelieu returned his check. Bliss was not quite so fastidious, provided understandings were kept vague. "Now, Mr. Bliss, we want to make this contribution," said John D. Archbold of the Standard Oil Company, handing over $100,000. "But," he chose his words carefully, "we do not want to do it without its being known and thoroughly approved of by the powers that be." Bliss smiled. "You need have no apprehension about it whatever," he said. At 10 a.m. on 22 September, Judge Parker drove unrecognized through the streets of Lower Manhattan. He entered the Hoffman House by a side door and was at once closeted with Democratic campaign planners. As they urgently and gloomily conferred, a bedlam of steam whistles signaled the passage down the East River of an important vessel. It was the USS Sylph, the smaller of Roosevelt's two official yachts, cruising white and silver between crowds lining either bank. The president strolled on deck, accompanied by a bulldog pup and waving a black slouch hat. He was on his way back to Washington. The bedlam continued as the Sylph rounded Battery Point. Admiral Barker, back from the Mediterranean on the Kearsarge, saluted the commander-in-chief with 21 thunderous guns. Meanwhile, Parker was trying to have a working lunch with the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Roosevelt, enjoying himself, ordered the Sylph to proceed up the west side. The steam whistles followed him north as far as Grant's Tomb, before he doubled back and crossed to the railroad dock at Jersey City. Cheers of 2,000 welcomers rolled across the Hudson. Finally, at 1:27 p.m., his six-car special got underway, carrying the presidential party, Mr. and Mrs. William Loeb, Jr., six Secret Service men, a governess, the entire summer White House complement of secretaries, stenographers, clerks, and messengers, plus a stallion, a bay mare, a calico pony, Josiah the Badger, the bulldog pup, and other pets. Parker's next interlocutor was Representative William Coward, who informed him that the Democratic congressional campaign was critically short of funds. He would, of course, need a majority in the House if he expected to prevail as president. The judge spent another day and night in Manhattan, and by the time he left town on 24 September, he was so depressed he would not talk to reporters even about the weather. As soon as he got back to Esopus, he ordered his horse and rode off alone. For the rest of the afternoon, he cantered aimlessly through the countryside. When Roosevelt got back to Washington, the little flags on his wall map of the Russo-Japanese War needed repositioning. There now had to be a cluster so close as almost to hide Port Arthur, where the Russian garrison was still under siege. Nearly 200 miles inland, the Battle of Liaoyang was inconclusively over, with more than 40,000 dead. General Kuropatkin's army was in retreat on the plains south of Mukden. Marshal Oyama's forces were extended along the mountain slopes opposite. This new pattern of flags pleased the president more than it did John Hay, who saw nothing but blood and snow for the rest of the winter and, trampled underfoot, his cherished open-door policy for China. "War grows more frightful to me as I grow older," he confessed. Roosevelt, younger and less sentimental, saw the possibility of a favorable balance of power developing in the East. He was prepared to let the island empire colonize Korea, but not Manchuria. "I would like to see the war ending with Russia and Japan locked in a clinch, counterweighing one another, and both kept weak by the effort," he told Jules Jusserand. This would safeguard the security of Hawaii and the Philippines. He noticed signs of Japanese exhaustion, as evinced by General Nogi's failure to take Port Arthur. "Look how long they've been predicting its surrender." Jusserand, whose own government was allied with the Tsar's, reported un notable changement, in Roosevelt's views to the Quai d'Orsay. According to all the laws of political navigation, the Democratic campaign vessel, split along ideological lines and commanded by a man who would not steer, should by now have sunk. Amazingly, however, she began to ride higher in the last week of September, and on the first day of October gave off a blast of live steam. Joseph Pulitzer complained in an open letter spread across two pages of the New York World, "You have not kept the faith, Mr. President, in your promise of publicity as to the affairs of the corporations. Why?" Roosevelt's much-vaunted Bureau of Corporations had been in existence for 18 months, but Americans still knew nothing of how trust lords such as E. H. Harriman and J. P. Morgan operated. Both men, Pulitzer reported, were giving huge sums to the Republicans. He did not mention that August Belmont and James J. Hill were doing the same for the Democrats. "When they give something to Mr. Cortelyou for your campaign, they regard your acceptance of their tribute as an implied promise of protection." Pulitzer proceeded to ask 10 bold-faced questions. 1. How much has the Beef Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 2. How much has the Paper Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 3. How much has the Coal Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 4. How much has the Sugar Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 5. How much has the Oil Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 6. How much has the Tobacco Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 7. How much has the Steel Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 8. How much have the National Banks contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 9. How much has the Insurance Trust contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? 10. How much have the 6 Great Railroads contributed to Mr. Cortelyou? The aggregate answer, which Cortelyou declined to give, was less than half of what Hanna and McKinley had collected from such sources in 1900. Corporate contributions were actually tapering off, since the president seemed such a cinch for election. Cortelyou's friends knew him to be a man of almost ludicrous probity. He had spent the last 14 years paying off debts of honor at maximum interest, despite the forgiveness of his creditors. But these were private matters. Pulitzer's 10 questions, shrewdly aimed at him rather than at the well-respected Bliss, amounted to 10 very public slurs on Cortelyou's reputation. Soon Democratic campaign speakers were shouting his name over and over again, along with "how much, how much, how much," until the chorus resounded throughout New York State. Judge Parker alone maintained an austere silence. All Cortelyou said in response was that the next administration was going to be unhampered by a single promise of any kind. Roosevelt chafed with frustration. He was beginning to have doubts about his choice for chairman. The fighter in him longed to push Cortelyou aside and lead the most savage counterattack possible. Bliss wrote, urging him to have faith. "Mr. Cortelyou is proving to be all we anticipated, and more. His grasp of the details of the business in hand is remarkable." Roosevelt was not soothed. One needed to be more than a detail man to see that winning the White House was not enough. It had to be won in such a way that state houses were won, too, at least those vital to one's future executive effectiveness. Cortelyou did not seem to grasp the necessity of a Republican victory in New York's gubernatorial contest. After Elihu Root's refusal to run, the state GOP had compromised by nominating Lieutenant Governor Frank W. Higgins. Unfortunately, Higgins was a listless candidate whose first reaction to being dubbed Odell's stooge had been to stop campaigning and sulk. The Democratic National Committee, sensing weakness, had begun to lavish money on its own local ticket. If Cortelyou, or someone more forceful, did not immediately kick some fight into Higgins, the second Roosevelt administration might have to deal with a broken Odell machine and a Tammany Hall governor. An even worse scenario, not inconceivable in the event of a foreign emergency or major scandal, was that Roosevelt's current popularity could decline nationwide, to the point that defeat in New York might cost him his presidency. Pray get out and put yourself into the canvas at the earliest possible moment. Roosevelt wrote Higgins, "You and I are in the same boat. We shall sink or swim together." Higgins continued to sulk. By the second week of October, gloom over his candidacy was so great that contributions to both the presidential and gubernatorial campaigns dwindled further. "The drift here seems to be against us," William Dudley Folk wrote Roosevelt. At 1 Madison Avenue, the telephone rang for Cortelyou. He was out. Staff rushed in search of Bliss. It was the president calling, but the treasurer was out, too. Senator Scott came on the line. "Roosevelt, who is this?" Scott, "Mr. Scott." Roosevelt, "What is this I hear about Higgins? I hear there is some danger of his being defeated." Scott, "Well, if the election was now, I fear he would be defeated." Roosevelt, "What is the trouble?" Scott, "The state committee claim that they have no funds." Roosevelt, "Well, can't Mr. Bliss settle that? Can't the state committee raise the funds?" Scott explained that Bliss and Cortelyou had budgeted $250,000 for the gubernatorial campaign. Now, just when Odell needed to bolster Higgins's sagging ratings, the campaign was in default. The president exploded. Roosevelt, "I would rather lose the election in the country than be defeated in my own state." Scott, "There is no danger, Mr. President, no danger whatever of your not carrying the state. If the funds were furnished, I have no doubt we can elect Mr. Higgins." Roosevelt, "I will send for Mr. Harriman." E.H. Harriman was a heavy investor in the New York State Republican organization and therefore wanted to avoid a Higgins defeat. He was also, according to rumor, keen to see his good friend Benjamin B. Odell in the United States Senate. Roosevelt needed to harness the energies of all three men, financier, candidate, and boss. "In view of the trouble over the state ticket in New York, I should much like to have a few words with you," he wrote Harriman on 10 October. "Do you think you can get down here within a few days and take either lunch or dinner with me?" Harriman accepted the invitation, but found that his schedule would not allow him to come south in less than a week. The president detected a whiff of coquettishness and turned coy himself. "Now, my dear sir, you and I are practical men," he wrote again. "If you think there is any danger of your visit to me causing trouble, or if you think there is nothing special I should be informed about, why, of course, give up the visit for the time being." Harriman was thus put in the awkward position of having to push for a meeting he had postponed. Roosevelt casually added that there were certain government matters not connected with the campaign he had hoped to discuss. The implication was clear. If elected, he would be embarking on a program of railroad rate reform, such as a wise tycoon might want to know about in advance. When Harriman called for an appointment, he was politely asked what he wanted to see the president about. In the event, he did not get down to Washington until the 20th, by which time the October scare was moderating. 12,000 New Yorkers rah-rahing for Roosevelt at Madison Square Garden indicated that the president was still strong in the Empire State, even if Higgins was not. Roosevelt received Harriman, small, curt, dark, quick, late in the afternoon, alone except for William Loeb, who was soon excused. That evening, the financier returned to the White House for dinner. There were no other guests. Roosevelt spent most of the time talking about New York politics. Whatever else was said, Harriman went back north committed to raising $260,000 on behalf of New York GOP candidates. He had a pleased sense of usefulness and high importance. "They are all in a hole," he boasted to an aide, "and the president wants me to help them out." Harriman proved as good as his word, personally contributing $50,000 and leaning on several of his Wall Street colleagues. J.P. Morgan, who had once said that Roosevelt would be lucky to raise more than a four-figure sum in the whole financial district, gave $100,000, following up with $50,000 more. Millionaires virtually stood in line as realization spread that the president was likely to be elected by a historic majority. Chauncey Depew doffed his senatorial hat, put on that of chairman of the New York Central Railroad, and gave $100,000. Henry Clay Frick gave $50,000, saying that he would be amenable to further requests. George Perkins wrote three separate checks, totaling $450,000, with the good wishes of himself, the House of Morgan, and the New York Life Insurance Company. George J. Gould, of Western Union and the Great Northern Railway, gave fully $500,000. Other donations came in from executives of Standard Oil, National City Life, General Electric, American Can, and International Harvester. The flood became an embarrassment for Roosevelt. Did all these men imagine they were buying him? "Corporate cunning has developed faster than the laws of nation and state," he remarked to the reporter, Lindsay Dennison. "Sooner or later, unless there is a readjustment, there will come a riotous, wicked, murderous day of atonement." Born to wealth, with an inherited sense that it must be repaid with public service, he found himself increasingly repelled by those who went after money for money's sake, or used it to buy power. Unless wealth was chastened by culture or regulated by government, it was at worst predatory, at best boring. He did not care how little time he spent in future with E. H. Harriman. "It tires me to talk to rich men. You expect a man of millions, the head of a great industry, to be a man worth hearing, but as a rule, they don't know anything outside their own businesses." Democratic campaign officials could not hide their disappointment in Alton B. Parker. Although James J. Hill and George F. Baer had been generous supporters of his candidacy, their primary desire was obviously to stop Roosevelt rather than support Parker. His refusal to do or say anything partisan was irritating reporters and alienating voters. As one working man complained, "The judge hain't quite riz to the occasion." On 22 October, in New York, the veteran strategist Daniel S. Lamont tried to shock Parker's complacency. "Well, you are going to be licked, old fellow, but brace up and make the best fight you can, and when it is over, come down here and practice law." Like most presidential candidates, Parker could not believe bad news. "How do you know that I am going to be defeated?" "Why, they have underwritten it, just as they would underwrite building a railroad to San Francisco." The judge returned, stunned, to Esopus. He decided that if he